get in a time-dependent space-time. Specifically, we were looking at a massive scalar field in FRW, in conformal time coordinates. And the upshot is that you can rewrite the equation for your scalar field in terms of this form, mode by mode with an effective frequency, which depends on momenta and effective mass, which itself is a function of time, given by m squared a squared minus a double prime over a. And the situation we were considering is the case where we have a well-defined in-state, in which means that WKB is a good approximation in the past, and a well-defined out-state, which means that WKB is good here, and some intermediate region where particle creation takes place. And the way that plays out is that the key point is that there's not a unique solution of this equation. There's always two solutions, and you can superpose them together. What you find is that if you consider the, you define the in-mode functions, which are the quantities that as eta goes to minus infinity look like WKB, effective frequency here, that those modes, when you evolve them to plus infinity, in general, they'll be a solution. The same modes, they're still called in modes, because it's the same function, but now that function evolved up to plus infinity, will be a superposition of positive and negative frequency modes. Something like that. And the interpretation of what's actually gone on is that really what we've done is created particles. The number density of the created particles going like mod beta k squared, so that's the number per unit volume, per unit k space. And another way of saying this is that the vacuum, the in vacuum, which is the state annihilated by the original creation annihilation operators, which is the ones for which if you write the field as the sum over modes, then you put the in-mode functions in here. Whereas the out vacuum is defined by the modes BK annihilating the out vacuum. And that's where the same field, these two guys are equal to each other, but you represent the field in terms of a different set of mode functions, the out mode functions. It's complex conjugate. Now, and then the point is that in doesn't equal out. That's what gives rise to particle creation. So what that physically means is that an observer who lives at minus infinity, what he calls the vacuum state is the in state. His natural definition of particles is determined by the modes U in, because they are the modes that look WKB-like at minus infinity. And so he would use this guy to define the vacuum state in precisely this sense, and similarly uses the creation operator of A to define the states filled with particles. An observer out at plus infinity, on the other hand, he will define particles, positive energy, effectively positive energy states using this guy, the outmode function. The inmode function is really a superposition of the outmode function and its complex conjugate. And so he will use this operator BK, which ended up being alpha K AK plus beta k star, A.K. Dagger, to define his notion of particles. So this fact that two different observers can disagree on the definition of the vacuum and on the definition of particles is all tied to the fact that what we're trying to do is construct a single particle Hilbert space and the multiparticle Hilbert space, but you build that by taking the single particle ones together. And you do that from the Klein-Gordon inner product. Let me just do it I'll write the full thing out. Sorry. Do that from the Klein-Gordon inner product where you integrate over some surface, sigma mu, g mu nu, and then you have the root minus g, I'll put it in explicitly, and then you have psi 1 star d mu psi 2 minus psi 1 d mu psi 1 star psi 2. That was the Klein-Gordon inner product. I've written it now in an arbitrary curve spacetime. But the whole this failure of the uniqueness in what we even call a vacuum, the fact that two different observers can disagree on the definition, is reflected in the fact that we have to define this inner product. This inner product is not a priori positive definite, and we have to choose some way of taking each of these mode functions, of course, as solutions of the massive scalar field equation, but we have to choose some particular way to split the real solutions up into complex solutions, and there's not a unique way to do that. And the lack of uniqueness of that is reflected in this ambiguity here in the choice of vacuum. And in practice, it means that there are many different ways to define creation and annihilation operators. So in particular, this Bogoliubov transform, which in the present case is just captured by, we're doing things in momentum space, so two functions, alpha k and beta k. This Bogoliubov transform, what it basically does is say, well, it's always the case, if I calculate this inner product, and I put it in momentum space, then if I have one set of modes that I call the positive frequency modes, I can always construct a new set of modes, which are also legitimately call positive frequency, or positive norm modes, I should really say, which is a superposition of the positive and negative norm modes, meaning the positive norm and its complex conjugate. And so I can take superpositions of this form as long as I maintain this condition, which is just essentially that the mode functions are normalized. This guarantees that if the original mode function uk is normalized to 1, then the new mode function uk of ek is normalized to 1. So the point is that these free functions here represent the freedom in our ability to split the real function into two complex parts, hence defining the inner product, hence defining what we mean by the vacuum and what we mean by particles. And in the present context, now you could say, well, maybe I'll just fix a choice and stick with it, and then that's it, and never change that choice. And you can do that, of course, and that's what we're effectively doing down at minus infinity. But then the dynamics of the system, the actual time-dependent evolution of the universe, forces you to effectively change what you think is the vacuum state. So the original state that you fix to, whatever it is, it will evolve in time, and you'll come out with a different superposition of the state of the that original state will be some superposition of the natural state viewed at plus infinity. And so the dynamics really, in a sense, is forcing a change of vacuum on you. And so then, and that corresponds in practice to having particles being created. And so some of you are a little bit confused about this. It is a bit confusing at first sight, which is the right thing to calculate. The correct way to do the calculation is to ask, so if you start out in the in state, and we're working in the Heisenberg representation, the actual state of the universe is always the in state, because states don't evolve in the Heisenberg representation. If we're in the interacting representation and we switch the interactions to zero, which is actually really what we're doing, then that's effectively the same statement. So the state of the universe is always the in state, without any interactions, or if we just work in the Heisenberg representation. So if we want to calculate the expectation value of the number of particles we see, we should always calculate that expectation value in the in state. But an observer out here at plus infinity, he defines particles relative to the vacuum at plus infinity, which is the B vacuum. And so what we should be doing is calculating the number of B quanta, which is just given by the number operator is just defined in a standard way as B dagger B for each mode summed over all the modes. And then we're taking the expectation value of this in the in state, and then a simple calculation shows that this is related to mod beta k squared. Of course, had we chosen to calculate the expectation value of the number of A particles that you see at plus infinity, you would find that to zero, because we're still in vacuum. So according to the definition of particles given by the A creation annihilation operators, it's always true there's no particles. Okay, that point hasn't changed. Yeah.
So can we find a reference frame in the late universe in which there are no particles?
Right. So that's a good question. So can you sort of cancel out this effect? I think the answer is no, because you always like create more particles when you try to do it. I don't think you can cancel them out, right?
So we have no fiction.
No. I don't think so, no. And that does relate. So, of course, in the present case, it's you could say, well, an observer at minus infinity and plus infinity, they don't agree on their definition of particles, but they can never really get together and argue about it, of course, you know, because by the time you get to plus infinity and you find out you're using the wrong vacuum state, you have to send a signal back in time and tell the previous guy to change the state you're sending in. So in some sense, here there's no real disagreement in real terms. But in today, what we'll do is basically discuss the other non-trivial feature of quantum field theory in curved spacetimes, which is even in a static spacetime such as Minkowski spacetime, different observers can also disagree on the definition of the vacuum state, because one guy could be accelerating and the other guy could be at rest, and this is essential. This is called the Unruh effect. And essentially, it has to do with the existence of horizons. Okay. So, but sitting behind all of this is really this ambiguity in the choice, ambiguity in the definition of the inner product, because we have to make some choice of how we split the real functions of the Klein-Gordon equation into complex parts. That ambiguity is reflected by this ambiguity. If I have one choice, I can also make an infinity of other choices by taking superpositions. And this, in turn, is then tied to an ambiguity in the definition of what you mean by creation annihilation operators. It's a one-to-one correspondence between those two statements. So this is going to show up again in a different context. And so what we're thinking about here is, in a sense, situations where the state we actually call the vacuum is equivalent in observer-dependent ways. So some observers will see the vacuum state to be filled with particles. And there are three cases where this occurs, and it's all tied to the existence of horizons. Space-time horizon, so that's regions, that's essentially saying that a given observer is some region of the space-time for which they cannot see. And there's three classic cases where this occurs. One is, of course, in black holes. In a black hole space-time, for an observer at infinity, there's a horizon and can't see what's going on inside the black hole. there's a region of the space-time you'll never know about, no matter how long you live, at least in the classical space-time. And this fact means that the vacuum state that an observer infinitely far away from the black hole will use, the vacuum state will actually be filled with particles. In fact, the vacuum state will look like a thermal distribution of particles. And the thermal distribution of particles is known as Hawking radiation. So Hawking radiation arises in black hole space terms because the natural state that we call the vacuum is actually, to an observer out at infinity, perceived as a state filled with particles. Yeah. If there's no horizons, it won't happen. No. So, but it doesn't have to be a black hole horizon. That's the point. So the second case is cosmological horizons. And this is actually going to be of more relevance to us because we're actually, you know, for the purposes of inflation, we're mainly interested in quasi de Sitter spacetimes, which are spacetimes that have cosmological horizons. So cosmological horizon is kind of the inverse of a black hole. In a black hole spacetime, you know, if I can, a crude picture, we've got a black hole surrounded by horizon. You're out at infinity. You don't know about this region inside the horizon. You know, most sophisticated way to do that is to draw the Penrose diagram. So what's the Penrose diagram look like? So it's something like that, right?
It's like a diamond with a diamond.
Oh, let me skip that one. I can't remember. So I'll do the cosmological case. In the cosmological case, the de Sitter space looks like that. An observer located along this line here will never be influenced by the region of space over here and will never be able to influence the region of space over here. So this observer, there'll be some finite region for which they can never influence and a finite region which they can know. And so in this case, this is called the past event horizon. This is the future event horizon. This region is often called the causal patch. This diamond here, this wedge, it's the region which you can both influence and be influenced by. So it's the region which you can send a signal to and get a signal back from. So, and this is the cosmological horizon. And in this case, it's also true that the vacuum state, which is something called the Bunch-Davis vacuum, which is something we'll get back to later, is also filled with particles with a thermal spectrum. This doesn't exactly have a name, I think, but it was first pointed out in a paper by Gibbons and Hawking. So I'm going to call it Gibbons-Hawking radiation. And the last case, which is the one we're actually going to think about today, it's the simplest case of all. It's where we have a horizon because an observer is actually in an accelerated frame of reference. And an observer, and it'll turn out that an observer in an accelerated frame of reference can never see the whole space-time. So there'll be some portion of the space-time which is always hidden from them. And in this case, the effect, it's called the Unruh effect. And again, it'll turn out that the vacuum state will be a state filled with particles with a thermal spectrum. And this fact that it comes out thermal each time is no coincidence. It's really tied to the actual physics of the horizon itself. And we'll see how that actually plays out in the present case of unruh radiation. So the unruh effect is kind of the most weird in some sense, because the space-time we're going to consider is Minkowski space-time. It's a space-time where we have a well-defined notion of energy. We have full 10 symmetries. There's no ambiguity whatsoever in choosing the vacuum. Nevertheless, we'll see that to an accelerated observer in this space-time, even in the vacuum state, you perceive particles. And so it looks like you think you're in an excited state. Even when you're not, you're actually in the vacuum state. And that's because, again, that's because of a difference of opinion between a non-accelerating observer and an accelerated observer about what is the correct way to define the vacuum. Equivalently, what is the correct way to define creation and annihilation operators. Now, this effect, as we'll see, it's so small that it's actually not of any importance from a physical point of view, but it's very useful as a toy model, because we'll see when we understand this, we understand 90% of these two effects as well. In fact, in particular, this one more or less goes through exactly the same as this effect, but the unruh effect is somewhat simpler to do the calculations. So to make it super simple, what I'm going to do is consider Minkowski space in two dimensions. And I'm going to consider a massless scalar field in two dimensions. And that's because the equation of a massless scalar field is incredibly simple, and so it'll be very easy to solve this problem. As an analog, of course, this is like what we'd be doing if we'd be looking at a string, which are just a set of fields in two dimensions. And in fact, we're going to take advantage of that because a massless scalar field in two dimensions has a conformal symmetry. Which is the statement that if you look at a massless scalar on a metric which is omega squared g mu nu dx mu dx nu, that omega squared will cancel out in its equation of motion. So the equation of motion will be the same as in the metric without the conformal factor. That's what you have in a conformally invariant field theory. And of course, that property is crucial in string theory and in quantizing the string. Here we're just going to use it for no other reason than to make our calculations simple. So I'm going to use coordinates. Well, I'm going to think about capital coordinates for the two-dimensional space-time, minus dt squared plus dx squared. So t and x are going to be global coordinates that cover the whole space-time, meaning effectively that x, if I say x goes to minus infinity to plus infinity, t goes to minus infinity to plus infinity, that basically covers the whole of two-dimensional Minkowski space-time. And it's going to be useful to introduce light cone coordinates defined as x plus or minus, which are going to be t plus or minus x. So these are called light cone coordinates because a line, x plus is a constant, is a line, let's say x minus a constant, is basically the line x is t minus that constant. Or in other words, dx dt equals 1. And so something that moves along the line x minus is a constant is traveling along a curve for which dx dt is 1, and so is moving at the speed of light. So these coordinates cover the space-time. These are the original tx coordinates. The light cone coordinates cover the space-time as so. So these guys are the x minus is constant, and these guys are x plus is constant. Now, we're just introducing this mainly for calculational simplicity, but it'll turn out to be an extremely useful trick. And in these coordinates, the metric takes the form minus dx plus dx minus, simply because it's t plus dt plus dx, dt minus dx, you multiply them together, and you get that. What we're going to do, so the essence of the Unruh effect is to think about a constant proper acceleration observer. So acceleration we can define in a proper acceleration is defined as the double derivative of a coordinate with respect to the proper time squared. And so what we're going to mean by constant acceleration is that a mu is a constant. So before we go any further about thinking about the quantum field theory, we're going to need to think about what are the trajectories of an accelerated observer in our two-dimensional space. And we have to remember that by the definition of proper time, dx mu d tau will equal minus 1 just by proper normalization. And so this equation, so what we're going to do is go into the light cone coordinates for which this relationship is equivalent to dx plus d tau dx minus d tau equals plus 1. The minus 1 here gets cancelled by the minus that comes here in the way I've chosen to define things. So the velocities in the x plus and x minus directions have to multiply to give 1 in the light cone framework. We're also demanding that the accelerations multiply together to give a constant. So this is this statement, d2 x plus d tau squared d2 x minus d tau squared is equal to minus a squared. So that's that equation. The minus I've taken from the other side, that's that minus there. So we need to solve these equations, and it's quite simple, actually, because what you can do is you can take, for example, dx minus d tau from here. So we have, from that relationship, we have dx minus d tau is 1 over dx plus d tau. We can then differentiate that relationship and plug it back into that formula. We have d2 x minus d tau squared is, if we differentiate this, we have a minus sign because it's an inverse, minus d2 x plus d tau squared over dx plus d tau squared. Putting that together, we can take this formula, plug it back in that relationship, and rewrite that equation, and it gives us d2 x plus d tau squared over dx plus d tau squared is equal to constant. And so we can square root that relationship. And I'm going to choose you can, without loss of generality here, choose the plus sign because the x minus equation will have to satisfy the minus sign. So we can always choose the sign one way here and the other guy will satisfy the other relationship without losing too much generality here. But this guy is the acceleration over the velocity, and you can rewrite that as the rate and change of time of the log of the velocity. And having in that form, now we can easily integrate that. We can integrate A with respect to tau and then exponentiate the answer, and we get dx plus. So let me do it slightly slower. We get log dx plus d tau is a constant plus a times tau, just by integrating this relationship here. And so we get dx plus d tau is e to the constant e to the a tau. And then finally integrating, we get x plus is a constant value of x plus the integral of this, which is e to the c over a e to the a tau. Okay, that's the solution. Yeah. This thing, this is just the definition of proper time, right? So proper time is defined as such that minus g mu nu dx mu dx nu. And here, because we're on Minkowski space, I'm being crude and lowering that inside here, right? But of course, I could write that as g mu nu. Does that make sense? So this is literally just the normal thing you have to satisfy, that the rate and change of time is fixed by the rate of change of space, given the definition of proper time. So that's the solution for x plus. And then you can go back here and say, well, actually, I know that dx minus d tau, whatever it is 1 over dx plus d tau. So if that's the formula for dx plus d tau, we immediately get dx minus d tau is e to the minus c, e to the minus I tau. And so its general solution is x minus 0 minus e to the c over a e to the minus I tau. Like that. Yeah. That's right. These are constant acceleration curves. Now, without too much loss of generality, I can always choose my coordinates, so I'm going to consider a family of observers for which x plus is 0 and x minus is 0 is 0. I mean, I can always translate my original coordinates so that that's true. And also going to, for convenience, choose to tau here, of course, is the proper time, and I can always shift the proper time by a constant and absorb this factor of c here. So in fact, that's redundant at some level. Given the definition of proper time, I can always remove that. And this is just sets the origin, and I'm going to set the origin so that this is 0 and this is 0. So that we have simply the simpler relations, x plus or minus is plus or minus e to the a tau, plus or minus tau, over a. And if you plot those out, what those curves are, of course, written in this form, it's basically the statement that x plus x minus is 1 over a squared minus 1 over a squared. And if we translate that back into the original Cartesian coordinates, remembering that x plus or minus is t plus or minus x, so that translates into t squared minus x squared, that gives you 1 over a squared. Sorry, minus 1 over a squared. So if you plot out what those curves look like defined by that equation in the original Cartesian coordinates, then they look like curves like this. In particular, what happens, if I rearrange this equation, put it a little bit nicer, what we're saying is that x is actually, or ax, is the square root, and I'm plotting the solutions with only the plus square root on this side, the square root of 1 plus a squared t squared. And so what we see is that as t goes to, when t is much bigger than 1 over a, so there's some scale, 1 over a, that is a length scale, which is set by the acceleration. When t is much bigger than 1 over a, the solution becomes approximately ax is roughly at, or in other words, dx dt is 1. So what happens is that the constant proper acceleration curves asymptote to this traveling at the speed of light. Dxt dt goes to 1 out here and also over here. So in both here and here, the curves asymptote to the speed of light, and they come in and they intersect at some finite value, which is set by the acceleration scale. Yeah. Yes. It's just come through. It's the only guy that's non-trivial in these equations, right? So we chose the acceleration. A is the proper acceleration. It's the magnitude of the acceleration. Dx plus d tau is 1. Why is that? So that's the solution for dx plus d tau?
Well, it follows from the top equation.
This here? So this is the. So d2x plus d tau squared divided by dx plus d tau is a. So, that's just come from we took here this relationship. We differentiated it to derive d2x minus d tau squared in terms of d2x plus d tau squared. We took that formula, we plugged it into this definition. That gives us this relationship. We then square root that, we get this, and then we solve that, and we get this statement. So those are the constant acceleration trajectories. But the key point is to note is that no matter what the acceleration is, should draw that better, more symmetric. No matter what the acceleration is, the curves always asymptote to the speed of light, but they never go into this region. So this light cone here acts as effectively a horizon. A constant accelerating observer, constant accelerating geodesic, will never go outside of this region set by this effectively future event horizon here. And here there's effectively a past event horizon. And so this is what we mean by effectively saying in an accelerated frame of reference, if you go to the frame of reference in which these guys are at rest, then these curves should describe the constant, constant space coordinate position in that accelerated frame of rest. In an accelerated frame, these guys are at rest. But in that accelerated frame, you can basically never see the region of space over here and region of space over here. And so by going to an accelerated frame of reference, you effectively also lose your ability to see the whole space-time. This can be made more explicit by actually doing the transformation that changes our coordinates to the coordinates in which these are the lines of constant space, and the lines of constant time will look something like that. In other words, going to a natural system of coordinates that covers the region of space seen by the accelerated observer. And those can basically be built upon the analogy with what we've got, that formula down there. Essentially, you want x plus a minus to scale like plus or minus e to the a times the time in that coordinate system. And the way you can do that quite simply is define x plus or minus is plus or minus 1 over a e to the a, and a new coordinate, little x plus or minus, where just as x plus or minus is related to the Cartesian coordinates in that sense, little x plus or minus is related to a new set of time and space coordinates, which are the natural time and space coordinates of the accelerated observer. Now, since the original metric was minus dx plus dx minus, and if we plug in that transformation from here, we have dx plus or minus is, sorry, that's a, I got that the right way around, I went to plus or minus here as well. Yeah, I want something analogous to this relationship, so when x is 0, that basically the proper time here is the time coordinate there. So with that definition, dx plus or minus ends up just being e to the plus or minus a x plus or minus dx plus or minus. And so we plug that definition in, and we get minus e to the plus a x plus minus x minus multiplied by dx plus dx minus. So what I'm doing is taking the differential here, multiplying the two together. The exponentials come in with different signs, so you get the difference here multiplied by dx plus dx minus. And now we can map that back to a sort of Cartesian-like system of coordinates, where x plus a minus is t plus or minus little x, and this becomes e to the 2ax, and then dt squared minus dx squared, where I can write that out in a slightly more conventional way, like that. So this is the coordinate system in which an accelerated observer will remain at constant position x in that coordinate system, and in which the time measured in that coordinate system is effectively a measure of the proper time along the trajectory, when you see over here. Because if we take x as a constant, which let's choose it for 0, for example, then this is x plus or minus is e to the plus or minus at. But we know that the solutions are of this form, where what comes in here is the proper time. So t is actually the proper time of the accelerated trajectory, and x as a constant defines the different accelerated trajectories. This coordinate system is called the Rindler coordinates. It's the coordinate system for the accelerated observer. Now, the key point for us is that in this coordinate system, you have a killing vector. You have a time-like killing vector in this region, because there's a quantity here that obviously looks like a time coordinate, because it comes in with a minus here. So, in other words, the killing vector is such that this space-time is invariant if I do t goes to t plus a constant. If I write that in this notation, the killing vector k mu d mu is equal to d by dt, where the vector k mu satisfies d mu k nu plus d nu k mu. Now, this vector is time-like, as it seems here, in this coordinate system. But it turns out it's not time-like in the rest of the space. It ends up being space-like over here when we go to the whole region of space. And that's basically because this combination here, e to the 2ax, where it's coming from, it's basically a squared minus a squared x plus x minus. And the product, x plus x minus, can change sign depending on whether x plus is positive or x minus is negative. So when you go to the whole, the global coordinates, this e to the 2ax here, although it looks manifestly positive, Of course, it's only positive in these coordinates that we've chosen, but in the whole space, it's certainly not positive, definite. And that's, and this, of course, is reflecting the fact that these coordinates only cover this region and not the whole space. And the capitalized coordinates here are the ones that cover the whole space. This fact means that this killing vector here, it's time-like in this region, and that means it can be used to define a natural notion of energy for an accelerated observer, a natural notion of positive and negative frequencies with respect to this killing vector. So whenever we have a time-like killing vector, then we can define energy as the eigenstates of that killing vector. But that definition, whatever it is, will fail on the whole space-time because it's only time-like in this region. And what this means is that the definition of vacuum, the Minkowski vacuum, which is defined with respect to the energy, the minimum energy state, where the energy is defined with respect to the killing vector on the whole space-time, the Minkowski vacuum, you define energy associated with the killing vector d by d capital T. That's defined on the whole space-time, and you split modes up into modes which are positive and negative energy with respect to that time coordinate. That defines the Minkowski vacuum. That is not the vacuum seen by an accelerated observer, though. The accelerated observer measures time naturally with this coordinate, T, here, this little coordinate, and uses this killing vector because that's the time he measures. That's his proper time on the accelerated trajectory. So this defines something called the Rindler vacuum. Where we define a different energy, we call it epsilon, which is associated with the killing vector d by d little t. And so in this case, we'll decompose modes into positive and negative frequencies with respect to that time. And the modes which are annihilated in that sense are called that vacuum state is called the Rindler vacuum state. And the key point is that these things cannot possibly be the same because this definition of positive energy and negative energy states using that time can't possibly apply in the whole space-time because we know for sure that this vector, d by dt, is only time-like in the Rindler coordinate patch. And it's that fact means that this vacuum, the Rindler vacuum, cannot possibly be the same as the Minkowski vacuum. Furthermore, what it means is that the Minkowski vacuum will effectively be some excited state built out of the Rindler vacuum. So if we think about the what it'll turn out is as follows, in fact, that the density matrix, if we wrote it, it'll turn out to be convenient to think in density matrix language. The density matrix defined by the Minkowski vacuum actually in terms of ends up being a thermal density matrix. In terms of the Hamiltonian, the Rindler Hamiltonian, HR, H. Rindler, which is the Hamiltonian associated with this killing vector d by dt. Now, there's a simple way of seeing that occurs, a simple-minded way of seeing it, although we'll do a more sophisticated calculation. But the simple-minded trick that you've probably seen before used in the context of black hole space-times as well is if you take that metric as it's written and you change variables and define a coordinate rho, which is 1 over a e to the ax, such that d rho is e to the ax dx, and we substitute that in the metric, then the metric gets rewritten as ds squared is minus a squared rho squared dt squared plus d rho squared. And this metric has the property that it looks like, if it wasn't for the sign there, it would look like a conical metric. So if we did t goes to I tau and made the time into a space coordinate, then we'd have a conical metric. Just a two-dimensional conical metric. And the requirement that there's no conical singularity, so for these coordinates to smoothly cover a two-dimensional space, of course, we need that the effective angle, which is a times tau, ranges from 0 to 2 pi. Okay, because what we're doing is taking the analog with polar coordinates, where we have something like that, and theta goes from 0 to 2 pi. So that tells us that the imaginary time coordinate here, tau, goes effectively only from 0 to 2 pi over a. So that in imaginary time, not in real time, but in imaginary time, this metric, if it is indeed the case that when we take quantum field theory on this space-time, we go to imaginary time, if it's correct that the way we choose the vacuum should be such that there's no singularities anywhere, then it will have to be that all the correlation functions for the quantum field on the imaginary time will have to be periodic by a period in imaginary time 2 pi over a. Now, of course, that is at some level an assumption. It's not guaranteed at all that that is true. There's no reason. This corresponds to saying that assuming that the Minkowski vacuum is equivalent to the Euclidean vacuum, which is the vacuum, which is to say that if we take t goes to I tau, so we take out, instead of calculating real-time correlation functions, things like that, we calculate, in fact, the imaginary time correlation functions, so the field gets changed in that process, of course. In the Euclidean, in a true Euclidean theory, we would demand that there was no singularities here. There'll be some smoothness condition when we calculate these correlation functions. If the quantity we calculate in the Euclidean, the imaginary time framework, when you wick rotate it back, so you go tau goes back to minus it, and go back to the real time, if that indeed correctly picks out the Minkowski vacuum, then we say the Minkowski vacuum is the same as the Euclidean vacuum. So what we if it is true that the true vacuum, which of course is the Minkowski vacuum, is the one we obtain via analytic continuation from a Euclidean quantum field theory, so a field theory where there is no time but just an extra space coordinate, then this argument will go through that we will be guaranteed that because on the Euclidean side our correlators will have to be periodic, this function here will have to be periodic when the tau goes to tau plus 2 pi over a, then that periodicity will still have some remnant when we go back to real space. And the remnant is that it effectively makes it that the correlators in real space are thermal correlators. And the simple-minded way of seeing this is that if you think about the unitary evolution operator e to the minus I ht, if you take that expression and you shift t goes to t minus I 2 pi over a, then this quantity shifts to e to the minus I ht multiplied by e to the minus 2 pi over a h. And this quantity looks exactly like a thermal factor e to the minus beta h, where beta is 1 over k Boltzmann t, which is equal to, in the present case, 2 pi over a. And this is exactly how it will play out, although we're going to do an actual serious calculation of this rather than this hand-waving argument. And so the upshot is that in the accelerated frame, an accelerated observer will see relative to his or her vacuum choice, which is set by the Rindle vacuum, so that's the vacuum of an accelerated observer, the one chosen as the minimum energy state with respect to this definition, that observer will see, because the real state is actually the Minkowski vacuum, that's the actual state of the universe, the Minkowski vacuum will look to that accelerated observer as a thermal state filled with particles, a thermal spectrum of particles at a temperature such that K Boltzmann T is set by the acceleration over 2 pi. And that's the Unruh effect. Now, of course, here we're using units where H bar is and C are 1 and everything, so it's instructive to actually see what the numbers are. And if you actually plug in the numbers, the temperature you get is whatever the acceleration scale is over 10 to the 19 meters per second multiplied by 1 Kelvin. That's pretty small. So you'd have to accelerate to as large as 10 to the 19 meters per second squared, which is obviously not a very easy thing to do, for that Unruh temperature to just be seen as 1 Kelvin.
I think I asked Unruh if there was a way of detecting Unruh effect, and
that there might be some sort
of related effect.
Yeah, you can do it
in physical, and
do it quite.
Yeah.
Like,
and he's trying to do
an
analogous thing
in
acoustic
type
of.
Who's doing that?
Unruh.
Oh, Unruh. Yes, Unruh. That's right. So we have to finish on time now, so we'll carry on this tomorrow. But of course, this argument is never more than hand-wavy, dodgy argument. You can't, you know, there is some logic to it, but it's assuming a whole set of things go through. That do actually happen to take place, but we can't know that until we've actually done the calculation. And so, well, tomorrow we'll finish off doing the serious calculation, where we can actually really see that it is indeed true that there is a finite temperature in the accelerated frame of reference. And then this is really a warm-up, in a sense, to the case that's actually more interesting for the cosmological point of view, that in a de Sitter space-time, so in an inflating, expanding space-time, you also see a temperature, because you have a cosmological horizon, which we're, you know, surrounded by, you know, it's the normal story that we can only see because of the finite propagation speed of light. There's only a finite portion of the universe that we can ever see, and in de Sitter space-time, no matter how long we live, there's only ever a finite amount of the universe that we can see, and that is what the cosmological horizon is. And because of that fact, the real vacuum, which would be defined on some slice that covers the whole space-time, is not the actual vacuum state that we would use, because we would define a natural vacuum state on a region that only covers the part that we can actually see. And so there's a discrepancy between the real vacuum, which is called the Bunch-Davis vacuum, and the vacuum that we would choose to define as the absence of particles based on basically the natural vacuum in the region of space we can see. And the effect of that is that in de Sitter space, you also see a temperature. You also see that the actual vacuum state looks like a thermal thermally excited state with a temperature that's proportional to the Hubble constant. Okay, so it goes to zero as it should do when h is zero, and the larger the curvature in De Sitter space, the higher the temperature. And of course, this is all closely related to what happens in black hole spacetimes and the temperature of Hawking radiation. And in that case, the temperature goes like the inverse mass of the black hole. So it actually, as the mass gets smaller, the temperature actually increases. And all these three calculations, there's a dodgy argument for all three of them based on this analytic continuation. But there's a more sophisticated argument, and it goes through more or less the same in each one of them, how it works, and it's all to do with the physics at the horizon.
Okay.
That's E for Euclidean.